ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Chad Riley.
Hi.
How's it going today?
Ready to dig.
Ready to dig, and that we will. We actually have a Yeah. We actually have a really great conversation in store for us today, and it being Tuesday that we're recording this, it is Election Day. It is the day that Americans go to the polls, and, you know, that's going to play a kind of a important role as far as the conversation we're going to have later. So stick around. But we are not alone in the studio today. We got with us the awesome and illustrious Val Complex, Rotten Tomatoes critic and entertainment journalist extraordinaire.
Hello, everyone. How are you on this nerve-wracking election night?
Don't let her soft-spokenness fool you. This woman is fierce. I've seen it.
Thank you.
And alongside her is one of the hosts of Sacramento's largest gaming podcast, Video Game Bang, and a large proponent of diversity in nerd culture, Sir Aaron Carter.
Yeah, man. I'm here, baby.
And let's, you know, when Aaron's this. Here, we're going to throw down.
Oh, yeah. We're kicking pigs. We're doing it all. Let's do it.
You know, it's so great to have both of you guys on the show today. And are you guys excited for the conversation we're going to have coming up?
I'm interested, definitely. I mean, what the research that we had to do beforehand, I didn't expect to go into that liking it as much as I did, but we'll get into it.
Oh yeah. And Val, you stoked to bring your unique thoughts and your iconic take on certain things. You ready to bring that to the table today?
I'm always ready, you know. I'm just one of those people that has a lot to say, so I can just wing it.
There you go. The Filmlosophers is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded even on election night at VGB Studios in Sacramento, California. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, keep in mind that you can subscribe to The Filmlosophers and download previous episodes on your favorite platforms, including Libsyn, iTunes, Audioboom, Stitcher, Google Play, or Player FM. Filmlosophers fans, social media is also a great place to connect. Like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/philosophy101. And you can also check out all our episodes as well as other great podcasts on our network at vgbstudios.com. So before we head into our big topic that we got, we're going to hit some movie news. And at the very top of that list, we got Ezra Miller. We got Ezra Miller. He shares his thoughts on...
We got Ezra Miller without a director.
Without a director. He shares his thoughts, finally, on the director debacle of The Flash. So it's been no secret to anyone about the issues surrounding the upcoming Warner Brothers and DC film, The Flash. From the unique casting of Ezra Miller to play the iconic speedster, the unique Easter egg scenes in Batman vs. Superman and Suicide Squad, not to mention the Justice League trailer, suffering the loss of directors including the duo Phil Lord and Chris Miller, director Seth Graham Smith, and now the latest news that debuted last week, the loss of director Rick Fumoyiwa. The Flash can't seem to get a break, so now we're hearing from the star of the film, Ezra Miller himself, about his thoughts on the craziness. So before we get into anything about what he actually says, what do you guys think as far as the trajectory so far with how The Flash is doing and why you think this is probably going to be one of the most troublesome films that DC is ever probably going to put out?
I think the biggest villain in The Flash is probably the executives at Warner Brothers.
Oh, love
it, love it already.
They are their own worst enemy.
That's true.
It just doesn't look good. Three directors.
Yeah. I mean, four if you want to include both. Anyway, yeah.
I also would like to point out that I think they approached Lexi Alexander about it.
You know what? Just to kind of interject real quick, I actually saw you post that. I actually took that and added it to the article that I had written for Nerd Reactor in regards to that. So thank you. I didn't get a chance to
talk about it last week, too, how she tweeted basically, don't call me.
I think they had already contacted her because she was like, no, I'm not going to take it. Because if three other people have left, then I don't want it.
Yeah.
And I was like, dang.
She didn't want to jump on that sinking ship. No. Aaron, you're a huge fan of comics, and I know you're such a resource for that kind of things. What's your take on DC and Warner Brothers, I guess, method of trying to get this film off the ground? Their kind of method of madness?
You mean meth.
There you go.
Just meth.
They started... Okay, so with the movie, they started off the same way they started their whole universe. They started off tripping. It's like they were in a race, but they tripped right off the bat. And then they were like, you know, let's just try to keep running. Let's just, it doesn't matter. We're in last place. Let's just keep on trying. And then they tripped again. And they're like, let's just keep on running. So with this one, it just seems like that's what they're doing. Right off the bat, you know, the gun is sound. It's starting a race. They fall. Boom. And now they've fallen four times because they've lost. And they're just going, we're going to keep running. They've already committed. So it's like somebody telling a big lie.
Yeah.
And they just can't, you know, come truth, you know, like come to the truth because they got to save face. So DC is going to continue to push this. They don't care if they have to go with the worst director in the world. They can get Tommy Wiseau to start directing, you know, The Flash, and they'll still push this thing out because they want this universe like Marvel has this universe.
I did not hit her.
Yeah, oh, exactly. Hi, Mark.
Well, and so, they've got a schedule to stick to. I mean, they went all out and said this movie comes out this time, that one comes out that time. They're all interconnected, so they have to come out in order. I mean, they kind of dug themselves a hole that they can't get out of.
So when do you save face, or not save face, but when do you come to the realization that this time frame is not good for your storytelling, and just be like, you know what, let's back up a little, you know, we made a mistake, we try to rush things out, we really care about our property.
Well,
let's put this
and
out.
That's the ironic thing, because they really didn't try to rush it out. I mean, these movies have been in construction for 30 years, some of them.
Really?
You know? Oh, yeah. They've been trying to do a Wonder Woman movie for, what, 20-something years. They just couldn't find the right... Number one, the technology might not have been good enough, or they just couldn't find the right angle into the story. Now, The Flash specifically, I don't know if that's been on the docket for that long.
That's what I'm talking about.
But the entire universe, it all hinges, everything hinges on everything else, you know, because they're trying to, you know, kind of take the same type of approach that Marvel has taken in saying they all coexist in the same universe. They have some stories that are shared stories and other stories that are standalone.
Okay, but the thing I don't understand then is, what's the real excuse? The only excuse I can see is we couldn't find the right actress or something like that. You have the Holy Trinity of Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman. Their powers and abilities aren't the big flashy thing. You don't need CG to show somebody breaking a wall down with their fist or something like that. Sure. We've done Superman all the time. Wonder Woman's powers aren't that far off. You know, she just super strength, flight, stopping bullets with some you know, cufflinks or something, some wristbands. You don't need that. So we can't say technology has kept us back. Especially when Marvel did Iron Man in, what, 2008? You know, far, you know, before, you know.
Well,
all
the Fifth Element came out in 95, so there's no...
Yeah, there's no excuse for all that.
We sunk the Titanic in 96.
So. I think it was a dash for cash, you know?
But what do you guys think? Is it like a creative differences thing, or is just... too much executive meddling? What do you think?
Who's the number one over it all? What's his name?
Jeff Johns?
I said his name.
Jeff Johns. You're going to say Jeff Johns is now.
Now he is. I think that's what they were lacking from the beginning.
Yes.
That one mind to bring everything together like they have over with Feige. DC just didn't have that. They didn't think that. They probably wanted to go their own way, and that's probably a board of people and, you know, too many hands in the...
Oh, for sure. Especially by now.
Too many cooks in the kitchen.
Exactly.
I got you.
Yes. I think the story was that every director was allowed to go their own way without executive meddling until Batman vs. Superman came out. And, you know, Zack Snyder was originally sort of in charge, and they were calling it the Snyderverse until the movie came out.
It's dangerous.
And then there were fights, you know, reports of fights and arguments over whatever. And then, you know, Ben Affleck got the power, and then
hair was pulled, nails went off, you know, the fake nails started coming off.
But you still, okay, so let's, because we're always going to compare it to the Marvel Universe. They always have different, you know, they have different directors for all their properties. Mm-hmm. but they always have that one guy that's like, and that's why, you know, Whedon, he bounced because he was like, well, I mean, I can't really make my, you know, type of, you know, Whedon Marvel story because yeah. there's all these rules I have to fall in line that Marvel wants me to fall in line because they have their vision of everything. So, and I always tell people, I'm like, it's a tough call with Marvel because it's like the arts. It's bad for the director because they can't really be themselves, yeah. but it's good for the overall
continuity.
Yeah, absolutely. Continuity, everything. Yeah.
It's similar to making, you know, stepping in for an episode or two of a TV series correct. Where yeah. it's serialized. It's going to keep going after you're done. So you can't, you want to make your mark, but you can't make your mark too hard because yeah. there still has to be somebody else who picks up the ball and runs with it later.
And that's kind of what Ezra Miller is saying here when he spoke to Collider. He said, for me, it's sort of a tragic relay race, and we've had a couple of really incredible people carry this baton, and their marks are left on that baton, and the work that they've given to the project will certainly be represented in whatever the final product comes to be. He's very, you know, very forgiving, I guess, is probably the word. He's very, I guess, understanding.
He needs a job. What do you mean?
Yeah, I was going to say, but all in all, it comes down to him being the star of the film, in my mind. It would seem like, of course, he's going to want to lean on the side of DC because of the fact that they're the ones who, in the end, sign the paychecks.
Yes, and then he knows he can be replaced as quick yeah. as War Machine was replaced from Iron Man. Like
poor Terrence Howard.
Exactly.
He's just sitting around waiting for this, hoping this thing doesn't implode.
Yeah.
And I can sort of, you know, kind of like, you know, Gal Gadot was doing like 2 years ago, just sitting around like, oh God, what's going to happen if this doesn't work out? So I can definitely see why, you know, why he would be a little anxious, because I hear a little bit of anxiousness in his comment. So
I guess that's true.
Yeah, I mean, all he's had so far is a cameo in one movie and whatever we haven't seen yet from Justice League, which could easily be replaced before it comes out if they needed to. But I don't know. I think it's very interesting, the whole tone, the tonal angle they're taking with the whole set of movies, the entire palette of the movies. I don't know that Flash is a character that integrates well with that tone.
It sure doesn't. It's yeah. disgusting.
And I think that's one of the things that is a huge problem for them on the backside, like in closed door meetings, is how are we going to get this character who's really popular and put him into this version of the universe? There are some things that just don't mesh well.
Because we all saw Suicide Squad in here, right?
Yes.
Was I the only one that felt like, what is he doing in this movie? Like, it looked so out of place. And he was only in for like 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I was like, no, let cops catch these people. Let's not throw that in there.
And that's such a unique thing to say as far as his placement in the entire DC universe cinematic. Because we know that the television universe, they knew right off the bat it wasn't going to work. They weren't going to be able to do that kind of thing that they did with Arrow. And so what did they do? They allowed it to be its own thing. They allowed it to not take itself so seriously. They allowed themselves to have fun with it.
Scenes happen in the daylight.
It's really, visually, you know, different, yeah.
And it's already racked up. I think they said the CW DC Universe has already made $1 billion. So it's made more than its entire cinematic universe.
And there's longevity to it. I mean, there is in no way, maybe with Arrow, but there is in no way in my mind that I can see the Flash ending in the next couple of seasons.
No.
Like
Flash took over. I think the brighter colors, the jokiness and everything like that, that became the standard bearer after its first season.
They
I
already have their Justice League established. They have their Trinity. They have their Justice League. They don't need to be included to include that group. That group in the films would just kill everything that they've built.
I think they're still scared, though, to do Batman.
Oh, yeah.
I still think WB is like, put him on TV, not in the full.
Well, that's where things like Gotham come
from.
Yeah, and that's they're treading the waters with Gotham. They're trying to see, you know, how much can we get away with without giving away the full cow? You know, it's like, you know, they're going to lead people on for just that amount of time with, you know, let's let them focus on, you know, Gordon for a little bit, or let's have them focus on, you know, baby Bruce rather than, you know, full grown, the one that people actually want to see. And unfortunately, I don't think Gotham's doing all that hot. Not that I know of.
Now, that's a show that's probably going to be over in the next couple of seasons.
Well, I called that from the jump. Like, I understand that Batman is popular, but I don't care about Jim before. Like, it seems like they're interjecting all these supervillains that are Batman villains, but they're putting them on Jim Gordon.
Yeah, they get an early launch.
I don't like that. No, because he's not Batman. He's Jim Gordon. Yeah. So let's cut that. So it's like, so
then well, if you ever wanted Batman? To transition to have Batman, then all the villains are old hat by that point.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I don't like the way they kind of did that. If that were to go away, that's fine. But I think the WB is, they're like, well, we can't really. When's the last time we had, if you think about it, the last time we actually had Batman on TV regularly? Was it back in what, the '70s with the Adam 60s, West?
The '60s, yeah.
That's bad. That is bad. That's a long time.
Aside from the
off.
Animated series, I guess. From the
yeah,
mid-well.
I mean, live
it was
action.
That.
I
yeah,
mean, that was brilliant. But I mean, like live action. Like we've had a Superman with Smallville and
right.
And
Lois and Clark,
Lois
even
and
before
Clark.
That.
We have multiple iterations then of Superman.
Right.
And we've got another one now mm-hmm. with Supergirl.
Supergirl.
And they even had, you know, that iteration of Wonder Woman, and they tried to revive the
exactly.
other with Adrian.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Alicky or whatever, which you guys should see the pilot. It's very interesting.
So well, let's get that Batman.
Yeah. Like with everything else coming out of the DC, there's one thing that we constantly say here, and it's that we're not. I mean, obviously, Chad has his heart set on certain Marvel characters and whatnot, but overall, we're...
Hey, why you gotta call me out?
Because it's the truth.
I'm fair to these other properties.
You have...
It's a hot mess.
You have a Captain America shield at home. I'm just saying.
Oh, you wanna see him on TV? You wanna see him on small screen? Is that what you're saying?
Who, Captain America?
Yeah.
Any day.
Okay.
All yeah. Right. As long as they do it right.
But the bottom line is that one thing that we're huge, you know, advocates for is great storytelling. And so, you know what? I'm hoping that in the end, this actually turns out to be a decent product, but from where we're sitting, it just seems like, kind of like Val said, a hot mess. So we'll keep you up to date as far as anything else that comes up in regards to the DCEU. But in regards to directors, James Strong is set to direct a J.R.R. Tolkien biopic. So UK director James Strong has signed on to direct Middle-earth, an epic story about author J.R.R. Tolkien and the tumultuous events that inspired his iconic novels, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. I'm a huge fan of Tolkien. Obviously, I was a part of the kind of hype when the movie started coming out and no one really knew what it was about. And unfortunately, our school had forced us to read it every year from junior high through high school.
Read books in sequence or read the same book every time?
No, the entire series year.
I thought that's what you meant. It just sounded a little different.
Sorry. So, okay. I mean, over time, I mean, much like torture, I mean, after a while, you kind of get used to it. So it's like, no. But
wow.
I got used to the book and I ended up liking it. I found an attraction to the actual story and liking the tale that went forth. So to hear that they're actually going to make a movie actually sounds pretty interesting to me. I don't know. What do you guys think?
They're making a movie about him.
Yeah,
about the man right? behind the story.
The life things that may have influenced his writing.
So you'll see stuff mm-hmm. about the war.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because he was what? He was a code breaker or something? He wrote languages or something like that, right?
There was something, yeah. Or he was a professor of languages, I think.
Yeah.
And he may have worked, yeah,
and
as
that's
a code
how
breaker.
He came up with, like, the Elvish language and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Like,
yeah.
Dude, he created a lot of things that are, like standard in fantasy right now, from video games
yeah.
to other books even. You
I
know?
Mean, that stuff is dense. What, right. what he put, what
yes.
he ultimately ended up with just in those core books is dense.
Oh, yeah.
It's ridiculous. So kind of to see his background. And I've seen other people do like small snippets of it, you know, like a little 15-minute segment on them or
sure.
something like that and other things. But he's going for the full-blown documentary here, I'm guessing, right?
Yeah, it's supposed to be an entire biopic. So the movie, which is called Middle-earth, is described as an epic story about the famous fantasy author and the tumultuous events that inspired his iconic novels, The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. A story written by Angus Fletcher, who gathered materials on Tolkien through 6 years of archival research and personal interviews, will highlight Tolkien's early life and love affair with future wife Edith Bratt, as well as his turbulent experiences in the First World War that influenced his Middle Earth stories. So it's going to cover pretty much the entire portion of his life that really kind of jump-started him creating the Lord of the Rings, you know, series and The Hobbit, obviously. So
now, what do you expect out of this? Do you expect something like a kind of like A Beautiful Mind type of thing, where they go back and forth between reality.
You know what, I was kind of thinking similar vein. I was thinking Big Fish.
Yes,
where you end up with like, oh, these are the real people that inspired the characters.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I would kind of see, or I would like to see from that.
That'd be interesting. I'm not all too familiar though with James Strong's work. I'm not.
He's done mostly British television.
That would make.
I looked him up.
Yeah, I'm looking at his stuff here, and I'm like, the names sound familiar, but probably from people who are more bigger fans of like British television, like Broadchurch. That sounds familiar. Grace Point.
Yeah, they're procedurals.
He was in
some of them are probably period pieces.
Yeah, Downton Abbey.
Well, yeah, see, I never watched any of that stuff.
Yeah. I'm not sure where the kind of allure for them to decide or for him to kind of be like, oh, okay, I'll take this. It was like one of those free up for grab kind of things. Like, who wants this? Oh, I'll take it kind of deal. Because it just doesn't seem to connect as far as him directing this.
Oh, the man did Doctor Who, so it connects.
Oh, when did he, which Doctor was he a part of?
I don't have the window open on my computer anymore.
Doctor Eddie, can you tell me? It is during the 2007 series.
What's that, Eccleston?
I will tell you right now. Tennant.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
So
that had quite a few.
Oh yeah,
that period episodes, didn't it?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah,
where they
it
were
definitely
in a specific
did.
Time.
Yeah. So, any ideas? So, if you guys were in charge of casting, do you have any ideas of who you guys would want to see play Tolkien?
Not one person.
No.
Really?
I haven't lended any bit of thought to it.
What's his... hold on.
I know, now I'm like, what did he look like?
Yeah, I have to see a picture of him. I have no idea what he looks like. Like...
So any image that you look up, remember this is like his younger years, so... It,
well, that's gonna what say, it's going to yeah, be, these are, right? These yeah. are him... As an elder statesman.
He looks like Winston Churchill.
Yeah, so we can just dig Winston up out
of
the grave.
I was going to say, we can't necessarily, you know.
Let's just face it, it's going to be Patrick Stewart anyway.
Patrick Stewart?
Yeah.
No, I was going to say Benedict Cumberbatch as young him, because he does every period.
No, that's not a Benedict Cumberbatch. That's
I don't
more...
know. He could rock the side part and the mustache.
That could be Tom Hiddleston.
I was going to say that could be a possible Tom Hiddleston, maybe a little bit more of a mustached Ryan Gosling.
Okay, I can see Gosling playing.
Don't trust Gosling with the British accent.
The British accent would be too troublesome.
We gotta have some kind of hope, guys. Come on,
bring in somebody new. Maybe
there's been a surge of different, you know, biopics for authors because. There's another biopic in the works for the, I forgot its name, but the gentleman who created Wonder Woman, that is in the works to become a movie with Luke Evans starring as the author of the Wonder Woman comic and all the things he had to go through to get it written.
Well, that's pretty much all the news we know about as far as that film. So we'll keep our ears to the ground and see what else comes up about it. But that does... transition us into our actual classroom discussion. Ladies and gentlemen, we're not going to have a featured presentation. We're going to actually have what's called a classroom discussion here. And it's going to be some new territory for us, because we're not going to be focusing on a review, but we're actually going to be focusing on a dialogue that was inspired by a documentary that we happen to see. It was a documentary that was released recently on Netflix. And we saw it as a really great opportunity, especially today, it being election day and it being a day where, honestly, the course of America may change by tomorrow. And I can't think of any other topic to kind of hit than something that has been kind of bounced around as far as on in the presidential election and in topics than what's hit in this new Netflix series or Netflix documentary called 13. So the film is a unique take on the correctional system and the prison system and how the 13th Amendment kind of makes way for certain things like this to go about. And we'll talk a bit about it up ahead, but it really
join the gang. It starts by building some educational context around the 13th Amendment, the specific words that are penned in the 13th Amendment, and then it builds a case, you know, far beyond just those words on paper, which is very compelling. And for someone like me, who did not grow up with a lot of awareness of many of the nuances involved in this film, it was highly educational for me.
I've definitely been encouraging all my white friends to watch it. There were some things that I knew, but there were some things that even I learned, you know, having watched it. So there's something for everybody in the 13th.
Film, you know, honestly, film is just, it's such a large and broad spectrum. Like from the beginning of time, cinema has pretty much become the manifestation of the world's history, scene by scene. Film has been able to capture the past, present, and even in some cases the future of our world, mounting it into celluloid for all the world to see. So the genre that we're talking about tonight, of course, is documentary filmmaking. There's been many that have been able to take the lives and events of the world, some you may not even have heard of, and have been able to capture it so that moviegoers can experience it. The genre holds many iconic and controversial films such as 1983's Sans Soleil, 1994's Hoop Dreams, 1975's Welfare, 1985's Shoah, and the recent release and the kind of the focal point of tonight's topic coming from Netflix, and the topic is 13th. So directed by critically acclaimed filmmaker Ava DuVernay, 13th is a hard-hitting documentary centered on race in the United States criminal justice system. Titled after the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which outlawed slavery unless as a punishment for a crime, DuVernay's documentary argues that slavery is being effectively perpetrated through mass incarceration. The film was actually filmed in secrecy, and it was only revealed after it was announced as the opening film for the 2016 New York Film Festival. It was later released on Netflix on October 7th of this year. So, like I said, rather than review the film, one of the great attributes of an incredible film is whether or not it can cause its viewers to create conversations about it, based off of it or however. So that's what we're going to do tonight, and we're going to have what we like to call a classroom discussion. So, right off the bat, Aaron, what were some of your initial reactions to the film?
Well, like Val said, I definitely learned some things from it that I didn't know before. It made me look at some of the things that I had, some, you know, preconceived notions that I had myself in a different light. It was an eye-opening experience, definitely. Things that they discussed there when I was too young to understand, that I never even bothered to go back to, like, you know, like double check and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They brought it up and I'd be like, oh, wow, I didn't look at it. Any of this stuff when I was younger, like, you know, it never occurred to me. But it was something that I think a mass amount of people, one, should see. Like, everybody should at least see it once. I don't believe it'll change everybody's mind, but I think it'll get you definitely talking about some things. Yeah.
And one thing I want to preface with this conversation, just because, for those of you who know us and have listened, or if this is your first time hearing us and you're checking us out because of the topic, one of the things that we like to have on this show is kind of a mindset of unity. We're not here to pick fights with each other. We're not here to throw punches. We're here to discuss and examine the content that's given in films. So when we talk tonight, obviously, you know, we wanted to have a really good mix of diversity here, and of course, like I said, we have Val and we have Sir Aaron Carter, myself and Chad here at the table, and we have a good mix of both. You know, we have, you know, someone of white descent.
You needed black people.
Well, yes,
let's call a spade a spade. You needed black people.
Well, see, but that's the thing, though, is it's not just, and that's one of the great things that I gathered from the film as well. One thing that I really pulled from it is that this type of thing, although it is focused on the African-American community, one thing that it kind of also hits on as well is that minority aspect as well. The overall impact that it has in the minority culture, and I may not sound like it, folks, but I promise you, I'm Hispanic, and I even though I don't sound like it, well, it only takes one person on the street.
You have an accent, brother?
Come on. Well, no, I mean, I've called people back up from home out in Texas, and they're like, "Oh my gosh, you sound white."
Oh, well,
and I'm
like, I mean, Texan is terrible. Different. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah, because I lost my y'all or something,
Yeah. Terrible. Yeah, my whole family's from Texas.
But in all honesty, it doesn't matter how we are, or how as far as personality wise, or even, you know, what our appearance is. It takes one glance from one person to automatically judge who we are even before we get to talk, just because we are minorities.
But I give you props for, you know, I give you props for, you know, having me out, because there are podcasts and people who don't have disenfranchised communities in conversations like this. And I think it's important to have people that can identify and relate. You know, people who can understand, empathize, people that can come from different areas on a different topic. So
I would say definitely for me, I am the white guy in the room. I'm, you know, okay with that. But for me watching the film, I think one of the things that sat with me by the end of it, that sat with me the most, was how much I just was ignorant to. Like, how much it's not part of my direct, like, familial history to have to confront these topics. And so, you know, you don't know what you don't know to some extent, but, you know, I'm 30 something years old, so it's beyond time for me to know what I haven't known, you know, for a while. And so from that perspective, I thought that the film as a whole was extremely beneficial to me. It's sort of like, it almost felt, and not to trivialize any aspect of what the film includes in terms of talking points, but it almost felt like cramming before a test where, okay, I just need to like catch up on a lot of information really quickly because we have this podcast episode, you know? So I just have to really zone in and really pay attention. It was definitely a different experience for me than casually watching even a documentary film that I found interesting, you know, say, I don't know, something on World War II or something that, you know, that I would just watch out of entertainment value.
Yeah. And it's you know what? It's so, it's crazy. Me, Val, and Chad were in the car ride over here, and we were talking about it, kind of pre-talking before we came here. And she was saying, you know, this isn't new information for her when we were talking about the film. And I'm thinking about it, I'm like, man, how many times did we in school learn the amendments, go over the amendments, you know, have to focus on, you know, oh, we're going to do a test on the Constitution Day, blah, 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 and totally go by what it says in the 13th Amendment. You know, I've never once taken a notice, and me being a minority, I you would think that would be something that would ring out for me as far as recognizing that, having people make that a point for me to know. If you're not sure about what we're talking about, the 13th Amendment, which is kind of the focal point of this documentary, the 13th Amendment declares that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. This ultimately says that this amendment was created post the Civil War, when the government decided to do away with slavery. And so they created the 13th Amendment, which pretty much states no more slaves. In the beginning, it says we're putting away with slaves. And then it kind of like jumps out of the bushes and says, except...
Yeah, it throws a butt in there.
Yeah, but
if you're a criminal.
Yeah, if you're somebody, you know, of lesser value in society, you know, and you know, slated as a criminal, then we can make an exception for you.
And I mean, from that point in the documentary, like when they read that, I was like, is that how it's written now? We didn't go back and erase that? Like we didn't change it, or like,
yeah,
put an amendment in the amendment or something like that? Like
the amendment.
I mean, and so it shows the incarceration boom, you know, like right after slavery.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay, we can't have slaves. Well, you're arrested. You jaywalked.
And for stupid stuff too.
Because,
like Chad, my growing up, me being in Texas, the focus wasn't on you didn't really see a lot of it where I was living in San Antonio. You didn't see a lot of the issues with being Hispanic because the majority of people in San Antonio were Hispanic, you know, plain and simple. There was whites. I honestly don't remember seeing a lot of people who were of Asian descent out there, but
in
that
Texas, yeah.
Yeah. So, but it's crazy to think that this was something that went on and never even was, kind of like Aaron was saying, this was never even considered to change. And
well,
the
only reason why I can think is when Chad was talking about it, it's never been a part of, you know, and nobody really spoke to you about it as a child or anything like that.
Right. Like literally American history classes for me cut off, like the end of the school year, we had just reached the civil rights movement and didn't have any time to talk through it.
So, and I think, because it's ugly, it's yes. gritty, it's dirty. It's a bad stain on American history. One of the many. I mean,
oh yeah,
I love this country and everything like that. But we've got some bad.
We got some skeletons.
And that's definitely a dark part in our time. And the way that they dig into it, and you see, you know, everything, like from the media that went out to you know, to, like you just said, arresting black people for the minor of
minuscule of crimes, you know, small. Vagrancy, loitering. If you don't know what loitering means, that just means you're standing around in a place
just
that they don't want
around.
You. Yeah. And it's like people were arresting the police force or whomever were arresting African Americans. Because of the fact that after the Civil War, the economic status at the time was like all in just chaos. Everything wasn't, you know, because unfortunately, like Aaron said, you know, this was a really dark time for America, and much of the economy, the economic system in America was based off of the selling and trading of slaves. So
the work and the slaves.
So you take all that away, and you're left with a lot of work done by people now that they have to hire and so forth. So what do? They implement this, and then they exploit that little piece and say, no. You can't sit there. You sit there. All right, you're coming with me. You're getting arrested. I'm going to go and put you back where you just got freed from to finish picking this field or to finish building this, you know, barn or finish doing these things. And I don't remember seeing that.
That was never. Yeah, in my schooling, I've never heard of the arrest boom or the prison boom, whatever they called it in the film. That was the first time. And it just made sense, like right off the bat, like, you know, terrible thought process. But I was like, put myself in the shoes of a slave. I'm like, if I just lost all my slaves, yeah, I got to figure out how to get these people back. And yeah, so you would exploit that small part in this amendment. And it was just like, this is crazy. You just went through a process where you had to, you know, a group of people had to fight for the right to be human, you know, just, you know, not property anymore. And then you go from that to prisoner. So it's like, did we really escape or did we just move to the side real quick and you know?
Yeah. So just change titles. That's all it really was.
And that was literally in the first, 30, 45 minutes of the film? Mm-hmm. And I was like, I got a whole hour plus more to this?
Yeah.
What?
Heavy.
Yeah, it was heavy right out the gate.
But I think what's interesting about the education system and what they teach is, like, you know, that Abraham Lincoln was this, you know, really great, amazing president that, like, freed the slaves, and we should be so grateful. But listen to the language of the 13th Amendment. His concern was keeping the country somewhat together and being like, well, you can't have slaves, but this is what I can do for you.
You see the motives.
You know, you see the motives.
The money motives are terrifying, in my opinion. Like, if that's what money motivates somebody to do, like, that's crazy. To break human laws, like,
yeah,
come on.
It's just really, you know, interesting when you think about the timeline and how even in your grandparents' time, you know, Black men and women were just allowed to vote. You know, just a couple of years ago, you know, Black women, you know, I know that women, you know, were allowed to vote in the 1920s, but no, that didn't include women of color.
Yeah,
it's disenfranchised. You know,
it's crazy because I literally just had a discussion with a coworker of mine, and he's 22, you know, he's fairly young, and I was trying to tell him, like, this isn't that that long ago. You know that, right? Like, we're in the age of the internet, so everything happens really fast. We get information fast. You know, I remember a time when I was a kid, if a movie came out in the theater, you know how long it took to come out on VHS?
Right.
You were waiting forever.
True that.
Nowadays.
Next holiday season.
Exactly. Right? Like, nowadays, it's out on DVD. We get everything quick. Everything's instant, from dating to, like, it's all fast.
Oh, yeah. We're seriously in what's I like to call an age of convenience.
Yes, very much so. So when I tell people, when everybody's thinking, like, oh, that was hundreds of years ago, you know, slavery or whatever, that was, you know, so long ago. I'm like, you guys really don't realize it wasn't that far back. Like, my mother, she did a, you know, what's the websites where you can, Ancestry.com.
Oh, yeah, Ancestry, yeah.
And we can only trace back 5 generations mm-hmm. before we hit our slavery mark in our family. And we're like, that's it, because we can't find any more information.
Five generations back from your mom or from?
From my mom.
Oh, from your mom.
Wow.
So I'm, what, 6? If anything,
yeah.
Generations from slavery? That's 6 family members living and dying. That's all that is, you know? And then I have no, you know, history on that side of my family. So it's not that. When she told me this and she showed me the documents and paperwork and everything like that, I'm like, so 4 generations back, they're still under, you know, some hard times, you know, heavily.
Jim Crow.
I'm not that far away from all this stuff. And I'm still, you know, I got freedoms that they wouldn't even imagine, you know? So it made it closer. It felt more personal than I had ever imagined, you know, once I found that news about my family. So then watching a documentary like this, it's like, okay, you know, I get it. This is what, you know, my family had to go through, you know. This is the things that they had to deal with. And it's hard to even fathom waking up knowing that you have to go through, you know, half that stuff. I'm like, if I can't go out a day without my internet, I'm probably going and shoot somebody. Like, that's tough. But, and then you see the progression of it as well.
Yeah.
You know, from, what was the movie, Birth of a Nation?
Mm-hmm. The Birth of a Nation.
And the fear monger that they try to, you know, put out there against us, and like we're rapists, we're killers, we're savages. Like, they had the guy in blackface on the mm-hmm. film, and he's like drooling and stuff like that, and she would rather throw herself off the cliff than to be, you know, violated. Yeah, I was like, that's really. And so when that's the seed that's planted in a lot of people's, you know, mind of that's how these people are, then it's just like, how do you wash that away after generations if that was the seed and it just grew from there? And it was tough to try to see, like, okay, where's this going?
You
usually look at a story and you're like, okay, where's my happy ending? You know,
mm-hmm.
where's my... And then the way that they kind of ended it with basically like, what's next? I was like, I don't know. Like, what's... What's next?
I thought you caught up in the rapture. Right?
What are we gonna do? You know, can I get an answer at the end of this film? Or
I think what's the most I don't know if disappointing is the word. I don't think it even describes. I think what's the most terrifying is just how easily things were funneled from slavery to, you know, criminalization.
Yes,
and how the pipeline extends from. You know, you got the slavery, the chain gang, and now you got, you know, prison work programs. And it's just so scary at how easily things were manipulated to become other things without people noticing that it's just the same thing. It's just, you know, it's just got a different name.
And Aaron kind of hit it on the head, too, because he was saying, you know, earlier, if you follow the money, if you follow, like, what exactly is the driving force for America at that time, and it's scary to think how far back that mentality is, but it seems like the money mindset is what drove a lot of the decisions that they made, like we were saying about the economic system, and then bringing back the African Americans who were freed to now be under the new title, like you were saying, of being criminal and pretty much stamping that label of fear on them and telling them, this is what society sees you as, this is what we're going to see you as far as, you know, you're going to be a wild man, you know, a rapist, you know, like you were saying with Birth of a Nation, seeing it ultimately demonized African-American males.
It definitely did. It made them, you know, and then you see all the pictures that depict them being hung and stuff like, and like crowds of people, like, yeah. It was a show. Like, that was a thing to see. Like, that was the newest movie out and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then, like, you're not going to go to that today. You know, like, Chad, you're not going to go to a hanging.
You Please would probably,
no. Yeah, exactly, right? But it's evolved and it's changed in a different way. So now we have, since we're criminalized, and it's like, all right, we send criminals to prison. And you forget about them, you know? When they're there, they're out of sight, out of mind, big time.
Right. I mean, the phrase is, Put you away.
Exactly. Like,
literally put them away.
But then we have prisons that are ran by industries that are motivated by money. The more I have in my prison, the more money I get. So it's in my best interest to keep this thing full, you know? So
we
flood, because we have a massive, we have 25% or something like that of the world's population of criminals.
Yeah, I typed this out in my notes. Hold on.
That is ridiculous for the land of the free, and you know, like, we're but we hold that record. Like, that's crazy.
But that's been
the intro stat, or very early on in the film, they point out the United States has 5% of the total world population, but 25% of the world's prisoners.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Of all the people in prison in the entire world,
the
25%
billion people in the world,
right?
Are take up a quarter of United that.
States. Yeah. Yeah. And we only have, we're 5% of the whole world. Pretty but outrageous. We have the, yeah. So it's a, and then when, like I said, compound that on top of the fact that, oh yeah, we get paid for each inmate type of deal. You know, we need to keep.
Yeah, there are incentives for keeping people
exactly.
in that system.
And that's amazing. Crazy. When the movie hits on that, it's like, okay, so this is something that they've been setting up for, you know, setting to change for a long time. And then when they start talking about Richard Nixon and how he, you know, him and J. Edgar Hoover were implementing this system, this sort of
Southern
fear,
strategy,
the war on crime,
the war on crime. Where it was almost like, you know, I guess equivalent to Reefer Madness, where it was like, you know, fear the black planet.
Yeah.
So they started doing different things where they, you know, you know, they were targeting Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and now they're public enemy number one when they're really just giving people the truth. And the things that they've done to black leaders, how they've just, you know, assassinated them, or how they've gotten killed. And this is why I don't understand, I don't understand why people don't get that racism is systemic. These sort of things show people that it comes from the top down. It's not just, you know, this is just what's, you know, this is just the way things are. No, people are sitting down, they're talking about it, they're creating things to put you sort of in this box so that they can put you away and make money. People have gone to jail within the past 5 years for taking bribes, for funneling children of color through the juvenile system to make money. And then people will say, well, racism isn't systemic. How can you tell me that when people in government are taking bribes to send innocent kids to jail?
Well, it's another thing, I think. It's an easy thing. So I will never know what it's like to be a dog. You know, can't even fathom that. You know, I can know, you know, oh, yeah, sniff around and stuff like that. Okay. But I won't know what it's like to actually be a dog. So I don't think it's even possible. Like, you can empathize. Another race can empathize with, you know, the black race, the Jewish race, you know, any other race. But you won't really know the fears and the dreams that they have, you know, from their history and stuff like that. That's actually one of the reasons why I was really pissed off at the what's her name, the transracial lady, that
Rachel Dolezal.
Oh man, I was so upset with that, but but that's getting off the point. So when you see, you know, when they're like, oh, there's no racism, you know, racism is gone, nobody's racist, that's because it's like, you don't see the world through the same eyes that I, you know, wake up with every day. We wake up this way and walk
and
out
I
the
think
door
that's what
this way
what I really, really appreciated about the film as a whole. Number one, there are many interviewees. There is a multitude of voices represented in the film. I really appreciated hearing different angles on the same subject. But what I really appreciated was it's hard to put this into words. Kind of a sense of, for those involved in the project and from the director on down, this is our story. So as a white individual, I'm used to seeing a lot of protagonists who are white, told from a white perspective, history, you know, often, you know, I can relate to in a similarity kind of way. Aside from the political elements and some of the economic commentary and, you know, how the system is constructed, there weren't a lot of people who looked like me in the film, and I really liked that because it was so educational for me to hear other people's stories. I was telling Eddie this evening before we were on our way to do the podcast. For me, it's similar, and this may be a really sad admission, but it's similar to if I were watching a documentary about the caste system in India, and I don't have an overabundance of awareness of how all the nuances from within that system work. And it wouldn't do to have people who look like me telling me, you know, in a professorial type of way, well, here is the flowchart of the caste system. Like, it would be much more impactful for people who benefit and suffer from that system for me to hear their stories and figure out, like, oh, this is a different experience of life than mine. And that's what I like about this film, for all of the harsh realities that you have to confront. There are several, you know, provocative moments in the film, be the visual. Many of them for me were visual because I learn a lot from just, you know, images or, you know, commentary. But, you know, there was that provocative element. And yet the fact that it was someone else's story speaking to me meant something to me that would be very different if it was just a talking head.
Yeah. Only, or just like, you know, a narrator or, you know,
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
One of the things in the film that I wish they would have touched on just a tiny bit within the black community is the self-repair. More of like, we presented this thing for you guys, you know, president after president, and all these things that they kind of did to you, you know,
yeah,
to you know, bring you down. Well, here's a way that, I mean, now that you have the evidence before you, let's not get, you know, angry. You know where it came from. We can fix this. We're not a broken race. We're not a race that just needs a handout or help or anything like that. We're a lot stronger than, you know, anybody's ever, you know, imagined. I feel, especially to go through all that stuff for years and still, you know, be around. So, you know, this is what we need to do, you know, as a people and stuff like that. Because now I think not just the fact that, you know, we've had a government kind of put us in the criminal role, but we ourselves have also started to take that criminal role a little too seriously and start playing the part at a lot of different places. And that's one thing I definitely can't stand. I've had deep talks with my family. Like, I live in the hood. I've lived in the hood my whole life. So I'm around constant, to me, negative stereotypes of black people.
Yeah.
And for some reason, still, me, my sister, we being, you know, growing up in that type of environment, we still strive to do better than what we see around us. A lot of people are like, oh, you're a product of your environment. I never understood that phrase because I'm not a product of, you know, my surroundings. And it could be a whole thing. I've been, you know, risen by a single mother, so I can't be like, well, those statistics that, you know, put this person, you know, behind bars affect me. Like, no, it didn't. I've never been to jail. You know, I've had a speeding ticket, and that's maybe because I was, you know, I was speeding, so I can't say that. I do know there's still racism and everything out there, but I'm just saying, like, as a people, how can you not want to, you know, be better than the way you're portrayed by everybody else.
Yeah, and it's so true as far as, because yes, like I said, we were saying earlier, the film does focus on the African American progression, or I guess just treatment of sorts throughout the years. But even in kind of what Aaron was talking about, that same mentality, that same, you know, criminal mindset has been, you know, glorified within not only, you know, your community, but as well within the Hispanic community.
Yeah.
Within the Latin community, as far as people saying, you know, wanting to live that life of the cholo, live that life of the thug, live that life of the Chicano who, you know, is hard and this and it's glamorized and it's glorified in the streets because that's like the only way to live. You know, that seems to be the only way to make it in these, you know, in this area as this skin color, as this type of, you know, race. So I totally get what you're saying, because like, take us for instance, as far as where we're at, you know, we're not those types of things. We don't, you know, exude those types of mindsets because we choose to, because we know, you know, that it's not going to get us anywhere. And we allow that to be the progression of our mindset as opposed to digression and allowing us to fall into that trap of this is who you are, so this is how you should think.
I think it takes everybody.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think there's one group of people that will dig us out of this hole. Because, like, at the end of the day, everybody is from the exact same planet. Like,
yeah,
two lungs, a heart, liver, you know, all the same. So, like, if we had an outside source come down and be like, well, why in the world... Like, you guys are literally from the exact same circle, globe, right? I don't understand this. That's how I would think somebody would come through. And, I mean, I've seen comedians be like, well, why would we go to Earth if, you know, this color can't get with that? I'm green. What are y'all going to do to me? So, no, I'm going to leave, you know? So, I mean, but unfortunately, I mean, I don't know, actually. I can't even say. I used to be like, well, I don't ever think I'll see it in my lifetime. But I've seen a lot of things in my lifetime happen that I didn't think I would see. So, if we can get, and I think we're getting closer. Our generations, the younger generations, this internet generation and stuff like that. I don't know what you call after millennials. But I think the further we get away from, you know, that old thinking, I think it'll soften it. But I think the hardest thing is that money factor. Mm-hmm. That
I think
that rears its head everywhere.
I think there's a couple of things. I'm going to counter sort of what Aaron said about there are some people who, I guess, you know, you could say, yeah, they should pull themselves up by their bootstraps or whatever. But then there are also those people who don't, you know, because when in the ghetto, there aren't a lot of resources and programs to educate people. Mm-hmm. So they fall through the cracks. And I believe that the communities of color were especially hit hard by the Reagan era.
Yeah.
And the cocaine crack epidemic that took, you know, a lot of our Black Panther leaders away, that, you know, got a lot of fathers and mothers hooked on crack, a lot of crack babies born. And I think that was when, you know, because the 70s was a high time because civil rights and everybody can vote and we're partying and it's all peace and love. And then, boom, here comes the FBI with crack. They just put it in the streets, put it in the ghettos. And then you see neighborhoods that were booming. Now the buildings are condemned. You got crack houses, crack pipes in the parks and all that. And I just think there was a point in time where people became hopeless. So they weren't sure what to do, so they turned to crime. Because just like you said earlier, everybody's going to follow the money. You can either go that way with the money, or mm-hmm. you can go that way. And yes, it's almost like a vicious circle where, yes, crack is bad, and crack is the breakdown of the Black community or communities of color. But I have to make my money because I have to feed my kids. So I have to put the poison back in my own neighborhoods to sell to them so that I can personally make ends meet. And I think that's how the sort of prison pipeline thing mm-hmm. began to perpetuate itself, because it was a vicious cycle. Yeah. Okay, now that crack cocaine is in the community, now we're going to go sell it to our own people. So the people that are selling crack are going to jail. The people that are smoking crack are now going to jail as well. So here we are filling up the jails. And then after the Reagan era, then the Bush era, say no with drugs or whatever came. Mm-hmm. And then the drug czars, who, you know, whose task it was to really do nothing but get six figures and earn the title because we're still fighting the war on drugs. And then, you know, here came the Clintons with the, you know, three strike rule and things like that. So it was just like a hamster wheel of sort of hopelessness. So I think people just got used to the way things were because ghetto fabulous life is what it is.
So we're historically good for turning bad into good. Like if you look throughout Black history, we find the bad stuff and we turn it into good, you know, the best way we can, you know, I would say. So, you know, but I've lived, like I said, I lived in the hood 20 plus years and I haven't seen any modification to my neighborhood that is an improvement in that educational system. Like my little brother and my niece can't even go to the same high school me and my sister went to because it's only been degraded over years. It's never improved as time has gone by. I would love to see some type of transformation within that hood. But a lot of the times I see just escape from it. You know, we need to, if I get a little bit of success, escape. I need to go, you know. I might donate a jersey or two to the local school or something like that, but like nothing that's solid and will sustain and will turn out more success within that hood. I mean, that's stuff I would see. And so the crack, you know, epidemic that went off and everything like that. And then, Black people going to jail for crack when, you know, powdered cocaine you would get like a, you know, slap on the wrist. Cause that's an elegant drug as opposed to crack cocaine, which is a, you know, whatever. I don't know. That had some lasting effects, definitely. Had some very lasting effects. But I don't know how long we can be on that one. Like, everybody knows drugs are bad now. Like, crack cocaine, it's terrible. So, like I said, after generation after generation, I think eventually somebody's got to catch on of, like, this cycle cannot keep continuing. And you know, we have to cut it off somewhere.
Well, they say that the you know, the best way to get over tragedy is, like, you know, it takes the same amount of time to get over a tragedy than, like, if a woman is in an abusive relationship for 6 years, that it may statistically take her 6 years or more to get over it. If there is 400 years of oppression, how long do you think we're going to keep going to this proverbial sort of hamster wheel thing that we've got going on? And then there's also the idea that when you look at slavery and the breakdown of the Black male and the breakdown of the Black family unit in general, you see the effects of, and I'm not saying that it should be used as an excuse, but you can't deny that you see it in modern day with the breakdown of the Black family, the deadbeat dads.
And the
single mothers.
Yes,
and the, definitely. You know, and, you know, mothers maybe being harder on their Black sons than their daughters, or the other way around. And just the treatment of, you know, Black women and Black men in the media and everything like that. Those things sort of ring throughout history. Mm-hmm. And I think people have a really hard, I think people now are starting to break free from that image. But it's just like, now, like, see, for me, a little personal story. I used to be in a gang when I was in New York, right? And I got stabbed in the back during a gang fight. And but I come from a product of a broken home. Both parents were crackheads, father in and out of jail. Mother was mentally ill and on drugs. So I was pretty much out there by myself. And so the gang was the family. That was like the family unit. Those were the people who protected me, gave me money. That's how I made money. You know, they gave me, you know, protection. And it wasn't until I had got stabbed and then we moved that things began to change. But the real change came when I was introduced to a program. And that was actually by luck that I was introduced to the program. And I actually went to live in Korea after I graduated high school. And that sort of changed my whole worldview. But without that one thing, I don't know where I would end up.
Where was that? Where were you introduced to that program?
New York.
New York?
New York City.
Was it in an inner, like a
an inner city?
Yeah, like was it in, or did you have to go outside that?
I had to go outside of that.
Yeah, see, I would like to see that.
I had a friend of mine who had went, he has a similar backstory to mine. He went to Thailand the year before, and I didn't even know. I was like, what kind of program is this? And then, you know, he told me about it, and initially, I didn't want to go. I was like, I want to buy Jordans and I want to go to the movies with my friends. And my sister was like, no, you're going. You're going to this. But when I brought, you know, when I brought the program to other people's attention, nobody was interested. So I think it's, you know, for those of us that get out of that situation, like yourself, Eddie, or Aaron, you know, get out of that situation. I think, you know, it's like a diamond in the rough because so many people are weighed down by the stereotypes and the perpetual sort of the heaviness of the stereotypes and things like that, that people just feel like there's no way out. There is a way out, but they...
Yeah, it's very true. Because it's to just add to that, I mean, you have people who feel like this is how things are and this is how things will always be, is kind of the general mindset of like a lot of the communities that I know, whether it be Hispanic, whether it be African American, that is the mindset. But the great thing, and I'm glad that the film actually pointed it out, was that we are now in an age of just, like we were saying, the age of convenience. We're now in that era where information is at, you know, at a moment's reach, at within the reach of your phone. You know, you can see information, you can find it on the internet, you know, you can find everything, and not just that, but you can record, you can catch things, you can see things. And the more and more that information is readily becoming more and more available, the more and more we can be informed, and we can tell people about programs like that. We can let people know. We can share the links. We can talk about it on our every social, you know, media account that we have, and to every follower that we have. We can let people know that there are ways to get out of this. There are ways to be, you know, to break the mold, to break the standard, to go above that.
I think it just needs to be introduced more into the places that's needed.
But how do you break a system that is constantly against you?
Yeah, yeah.
And when you, especially when you look at this current election and the way things are going, and that's why I keep looking at my phone, and I said I was not going to do it, but I've been doing it anyway, and I'm looking, and I'm like, okay. So we're having this conversation about breaking the cycle, and there's a possibility that we might just be thrown right back into where we started. So what do we do now? Do we burn it down? Or, I mean, like, what's the answer?
This is something I've been thinking about ever since viewing the film. The film, ultimately, by the end of it, left me feeling very humbled. Number one, there was a lot of just educational content I had never been exposed to, or had sparingly been exposed to, but not like confronting me directly in the face. So it leaves you feeling humbled. And I think that one of the things that is often missing from public conversation on issues of race, issues of systemic, I was going to say depravity, but there is depravity, but there's also just the system is already broken and needs to be fixed. But a lot of times when you look at something systemic, the problem is so big that the only people who end up talking are the ones who have boldness, confidence, and in many ways forceful ideas, you know, that are very not always necessarily militant, but very, very strong personalities and entities with lots of financial backing, etc. You don't often see the humble approach that says, I need to know your story, you need to know my story. It's something between us. Like, something between us is what will fix this. It's human to human connection.
Yeah.
At least as much as it is systemic. That doesn't mean that there aren't systemic things that can change. There certainly are, and that should. But if we only look at the construct and not the people that all of those systems influence, then we're still missing something.
Yeah.
And I think the film left me with just a profound awareness of both the humanity and the inhumanity of events that have transpired and how the system has come to be the way that it is.
you know, that we are in many ways inheriting. You know, we didn't create the system, but now as we age and grow in influence, we have opportunity to influence the system. And if we don't, then we're passively, you know, contributing to things staying the way that they are instead of changing.
And I think one of the great pictures, I guess, that you can say is kind of indicative of what needs to happen is what we have here. Like, plain and simple, I mean, we have a table of different cultures and different diversities, and we're able to sit here and talk about it, and we're able to converse about it, and we're able to really connect and see eye to eye, if not understand fully where each other is at, be able to hear out where each person is kind of fitting into that bill and see, you know what? I may not know what you're going through, but I'm willing to sit here and listen and meet you on a common ground, on a common level. So I think that is what is part of the change. I think doing things like this, where we talk about it openly and we make it a point of conversation to say, hey, this is important to us. This is valuable to us because it has to do with us. It has to do with, you know, whomever, whatever you are, wherever you are. I think that the fact of the matter still lays is that you are important in the grand scheme of things, and we should value that amongst each other. So, but that does wrap up another great episode and a great discussion. We had an awesome time here with Aaron and Val, and you know what? We hope this conversation continues on. So if you have any comments or suggestions as far as tonight's topic, leave us a comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/philosophers or on our Twitter page at twitter.com/philosophy101. Before we go, Sir Aaron Carter, where can people find you at?
VGVstudios.com, and yeah, you find everything there for the Video Game Bang podcast, you guys' podcast here, Philosophers, and yeah, articles, everything. You gotta go VGVstudios.com.
VGVstudios.com. Val Complex, my friend, where can people find you?
You can look me up on, if you go to Rotten Tomatoes, just type my name in the search, Valerie Complex. It's separate, not together. And you can find me on Twitter under the handle at Valerie Complex. I don't frequent social media too much. I try to take a break. But that's definitely where you can find me. If you have any questions, get in contact with me.
Awesome. Well, like I said, this was a very thought-provoking conversation. And you know what? This was really something that I think is very appropriate for the time of today and for what we have to look forward to in the future. So
I agree. Thank you both for being here, for being so candid, and having a different kind of show than we typically do, but in a very meaningful, positive way, I think.
Yeah. So from all of us here at the Philosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.